and welcome to the latest episode of The Lancet Neurology in Conversation With. I'm Sarah Passy, a senior editor at The Lancet Neurology. For our September podcast, I'm delighted to be joined today by Dr. William Jagus, who is Professor of Public Health and Neuroscience at the University of California in Berkeley, and whose personal view entitled The Complex Pathway Between Amyloid Beta and Cognition, Implications for Therapy, was published online in July and is in our September issue. Bill, it's lovely to see you again and to speak with you today about your work. First of all, please can you introduce yourself for our listeners and tell them a little bit about your work?
Sure. So I'm a professor of public health and neuroscience at Berkeley, and I'm trained as a clinical neurologist. I practiced for many years. I ran an Alzheimer's disease research center, and then about 20 years ago when I moved to Berkeley, I devoted myself full-time to research and teaching. And my research uses brain imaging, particularly PET and MRI scanning, to try to understand what's happening in the aging brain as older people transition into Alzheimer's disease. So we're very interested in the earliest stages of Alzheimer's disease and how it evolves in the brain and how particularly we can detect it and how our methods for detection might be applicable to both clinical care and clinical trials.
We published your paper online first, just in time before the Alzheimer's Association International Conference in Amsterdam, which I believe you attended. So could you just tell us about some of your personal highlights from the meeting?
Sure. So I've been going to this meeting for a very long time, since actually before it was even called AAIC. And I have to say the mood at this meeting was more upbeat than I've ever seen it. I think the availability of new therapies has really energized the field. And of course, at the meeting itself, there was the announcement of the new trial with donanemab, the Trailblazer ALS2 study from Lilly. And so that was really our second effective amyloid-lowering therapy that we now have. So there was a lot of discussion about that drug, a lot of discussion about the presentation. And of course, the paper was published simultaneously. So that was very, very exciting. The other thing for me personally is that we're currently engaged in revising the research framework that was published in 2018 that really moved the idea of Alzheimer's disease from a clinical syndrome to a biological entity that could be detected by biomarkers. And that framework is now 5 years old and needs updating for many reasons, not the least of which is that we have these plasma biomarkers coming along very quickly. And so we presented a working paper or a working document on that framework at the conference, and I got a lot of interesting feedback. It was a lot of discussion. And so we're in the process of sort of rethinking some of this and revising the framework. It's been a very interesting and I think a project, and I think it's going to also have a big impact.
That's great. I look forward to seeing that when it's ready. So let's move on to your personal view paper. It's got a bit of a long history, actually. So we contacted you initially to write on the link between amyloid PET and cognition after the FDA had made their decision about aducanumab. And we wanted you to review the evidence for amyloid PET being a biomarker for cognitive decline. But of course, the field changed quite a bit in the intervening period during the writing and the peer review process when the lecanemab results were published. So can you talk us through the challenges that you experienced during the writing in such a fast-moving field?
Sure. I mean, I hate to use the time-worn cliche of assembling the airplane while you're flying it, but it was a little bit like that. Exactly as you pointed out, we submitted that first draft of the paper in early November. And at that time, we already knew that lecanemab had a positive outcome because there had been a press release, but there was no published information. So we really couldn't cite anything, and we really didn't know the details. You know, when we started the paper, we started writing, of course, months before the lecanemab press release came out. We all very much agreed on our basic approach, which was that we all agreed that there's tremendous evidence that beta amyloid is very important in precipitating a chain of events that ultimately affects cognition. And it's a very indirect chain. I think many of your listeners will be familiar with it, that the idea that the beta amyloid initiates changes in tau, and that this then both the amyloid and tau probably work independently and together to cause degeneration in the brain that ultimately results in cognitive decline. But that's a very, you know, indirect relationship between amyloid and cognitive decline. So I think when we started the writing, we all wanted to point out that amyloid is important, but that a direct sort of one-to-one lowering of amyloid and expecting a subsequent clear, quick improvement in cognition might be a bit unrealistic. What happened, of course, is that we did see evidence for that. Now, I think this is where the complexity of what amyloid alone does it comes to the fore, because the real question that's still on many people's minds is how much improvement can we expect from amyloid-lowering drugs? And there really may be multiple reasons why it's not simple. I mean, the first reason is, as I said, it's an indirect kind of effect. And the second reason is there's other components or other processes that are going on in the aging brain that eventuate in dementia. So we were struggling with a number of things all at the same time. One is the complexity of the pathway, the questions about co-pathology, and at the same time, emerging evidence of actually what amyloid lowering can do. So we saw that first with canimab study. And fortunately, we had the opportunity to revise our manuscript after the canimab data were published. So we had some more information about the fact that this whole chain of events that I'm talking about could be relevant to cognition, and that lowering amyloid just alone could improve cognitive benefits. And that was always congruent with our beliefs about amyloid-lowering drugs. But both that study and the subsequent donanemab study showed us an idea of the size of an effect we can get. And this is where the questions come in about really, on a broad scale, what is the relationship between amyloid and cognition? Because on a broad scale, the question still remains, how many people are going to benefit and what is the size of their benefit going to be?
I mean, you talk about complexity of the cognitive impairment. In the paper, you explain about how amyloid lowering hypothesis cannot fully account for the cognitive changes we see with Alzheimer's disease. So could you tell us more about some of the different factors that you believe are also involved?
Yeah, I think there's a number of things going on here. So the first is the pathway itself and the indirectness of the amyloid effect on cognition. And the question of tau is really very interesting. And I think the donanemab study that just came out really shed some light on this, because this study was quite innovative in the sense that the study stratified participants by the amount of tau in their brain. And it's quite clear from the publication that people with higher levels of tau either didn't benefit as much or didn't benefit at all. And so the first point is that because the amyloid effect is indirect, we probably are going to have to take into account how progressed the disease is in terms of how much tau is in the brain. And it's quite possible that that's going to be a limiting factor in our ability to lower amyloid. But how that's going to play out in clinical practice is very unclear to me. It's very complex to make all these measurements of amyloid and tau right now. And so this is a lot of work that remains to be done. But in addition to the whole question of the indirectness and the complexity of the amyloid path, you have a lot of other data that suggests that in the aging brain, the problem is greater than just beta amyloid. And a lot of this data now, of course, comes from neuropathological studies, which show that in older people with dementia, it's quite unusual to see only beta amyloid and tau. And most older brains show evidence of other proteinopathies and vascular disease. So when we look at studies of people who have died with dementia, there is usually some evidence of other aggregated proteins like TDP43 and alpha-synuclein. And there's also very frequently evidence of vascular disease, either in the form of microvascular or disease or large strokes, infarcts. And so it's really quite apparent that there are multiple processes that contribute to dementia. And these are at least additive. I think our data from both pathological studies and in vivo studies show that it's least additive, and it may even be, you know, sort of synergistic. So I think this also could limit the ability of amyloid-lowering drugs to produce cognitive benefit. And I think the real problem that we tried to point out in the article is that in any individual person, it's very hard to tell how much of their cognitive deficit is related to this sort of what we call the canonical amyloid pathway, which is this amyloid tau neurodegeneration story, versus the canonical amyloid pathway plus all these other processes. So if you have a person in whom the amyloid pathway is the major cause of cognitive decline, it might be reasonable to expect that lowering amyloid could produce a substantial benefit. But if these other processes are also at play, then we don't know, and lowering amyloid may be less effective in such individuals. And really, the problem that we have right now is it's pretty hard to detect these other processes. We can detect some evidence of vascular disease by MRI, but TDP-43 and alpha-synuclein are very difficult to detect at present. There's some suggestions of plasma or flu CSF biomarkers, but we really need better biomarkers.
I mean, moving on to the future, where do you see the field moving in the coming years? I mean, what are the most pressing steps, do you think, and what should researchers and clinicians be considering?
Well, I think there's a lot of things we need to do. You know, one of the things we pointed out in the paper and one of the things that's been talked about a great deal is the fact that the cohorts that we're studying in our field are not very diverse. They're fairly homogeneous in being in the U.S. or throughout Europe. They're, you know, white European ancestry. And this isn't just a question of equity and fairness, although it surely is. It's also a question of scientific validity, because the fact is that people with different backgrounds, different ancestry, different socioeconomic situations may actually experience these comorbid conditions at a higher frequency. And so I think we really need to understand better how this canonical amyloid pathway plays out in people of more diverse backgrounds and whether it could be less important. And so I think it seems counterintuitive to suggest the idea that our clinical trials need to be more diverse, but I don't think it is, because I think if we can get clinical trials that are more diverse, we'll have a better understanding of whether our therapeutic approaches can improve everyone, or if they're relatively limited, and if these other factors limit the efficacy. So I think that's one thing that is needed, and I think there's a lot of agreement across our field that that's something that has to happen. Obviously, the other thing we need that there is, I know, furious work on is biomarkers for these other pathologies. And there's certainly efforts to develop PET ligands that can detect alpha-synuclein and TDP-43. And there's a lot of effort to develop better MR markers of vascular damage to the brain. I think, you know, looking at strokes or infarcts on MRI scan is really the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot of microvascular disease, and we don't have a good handle on that. And so I think these biomarkers for these other pathologies are really crucially important. I think it would also be really helpful if data could be pooled across clinical trials so that we could better get a handle on measurement of co-pathologies and how those affect clinical outcomes. And so I think that's another kind of thing in the future that is going to be very important.
Such a hot area at the moment. And, you know, it's been such an interesting discussion. And I think we could have talked for hours on this, but we just don't have the time, unfortunately. So thank you so much for coming today to talk to me. So you can read Professor Jagus' personal view online now at thelancet.com. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Lancet Neurology in Conversation With. And remember that you can subscribe wherever you usually get your podcasts.